With her fist raised, peers into the life of a woman who fought without fear against the injustices of her race and her gender. Dorothy's story is told, chronicling an indomitable and unrelentless journey of her efforts to make a real difference for women's rights, all the while giving equal time to the fight against racism in America. From this biography, we learn that the women's movement is not exclusive to white women. African American women were there at the helm, and Dorothy Pittman Hughes was on the front line. Professor Laura L. Levitt points this out with irrefutable historical evidence. Professor Levitt is the recipient of numerous honors and was selected as a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians in 2017. It is my extreme honor to interview my friend, Laura Levitt, author of the book With Her Fist Raised, Dorothy Pittman Hughes and the Transformative Power of Black Community Activism. This is Kayleen Peoples, and you're listening to Talk Agenda.
And very intrigued by this book. You've been talking to me about it for a while, and I can see why you wanted to do a biography on her. It's pretty incredible. So I'd like to start off with just a few questions. I know that she basically prompted you to even do her own biography, which I found really interesting in the beginning of the book. But tell me a little bit about how the process began doing this intense book.
Well, actually, I should say I have her on my syllabus for like a dozen years. I had a picture of her on the top of my syllabus on women's history within this famous photograph. But like everyone else, I didn't know who she was. And then I was doing this piece on Free to Be You and Me, a book on the history of Free to Be You and Me, and it turned out it was filmed at her daycare center. And so I met her because of that. I don't know if people know the story. It was done in a program that was done in 1972, 73, and 74, and the vision was really to remake ideas of gender, some of which are really relevant today. The story of X is one of the documents that's most often pointed to by trans activists. It's a story of a baby who's raised gender neutral. And the program itself, the television program that was an after-school special, was filmed at Dorothy's amazing community daycare center. She had started off really kind of keeping children in her apartment on the west side, West 80th Street, when it was a pretty rough part of New York City, and then winds up working as a welfare activist and securing a little bit of space in what had been called a welfare hotel, and then moves to a Chinese restaurant and then finally gets to build her own daycare center. And she builds this amazing space that becomes literally a community center. She had programs not only for children, but for their parents. She employed parents in the center. She had a youth activist group funneled through the center. She probably created one of the first domestic violence shelters connected to the center. A friend of hers had given her access to an apartment, and she used that to give shelter to some of her parents who were in violent situations. Her child care center literally becomes a community center and an organizing site. And she influences, I think, huge numbers of activists because of that.
Everything that I read was so much. First of all, okay, somebody said no, she'll find a way around. She understands about a community. So she knew how to involve people in her quest. She wasn't like a lone ranger at all.
No.
And she... it was really fierce. I mean, she's incredible. I mean, I could see the appeal and the seduction quality of actually doing her biography, because the world needs to know about this woman if they don't know about her.
They think they do because it's a really famous photograph that's taken of her. But, you know, I knew I had a book when I interviewed her and Gloria Steinem together. They did an anniversary re-photograph of this famous picture that appeared in Esquire magazine, taken by Dan Nguyen, of the two of them, the black and the white feminists with their fists raised, and reprised that on Dorothy's 70th birthday. And so when they do that photograph, I have the chance to interview the two of them together. And I knew I had a book because I asked them at the end of the interview, of course, the last question is always, is there anything else, or did you always see eye to eye? And Gloria said, yeah, we were pretty much on the same page the whole time. And Dorothy said, well, actually, I was kind of afraid to tell Gloria that she actually had bought the Miss America franchise for New York City. And she was afraid because she felt like that did not cohere with kind of the feminist movement in the 1970s, but she had done it because she does it in 1979, 1980. She does it because she has three African American daughters and she wants to send them the message that they are beautiful. And so she does this by buying the franchise and running a contest that has, I think, almost 7 out of 10 finalists are African American or Latino. And that was such a new step that she felt like it didn't cohere to the kind of the feminist protests against Miss America. But in some ways, it was a real protest in its own way. And in fact, she winds up threatening to sue the Miss America Pageant Association because of racism at the franchise leaders event in Atlantic City. And what's really interesting is I think her lawyer winds up selling her out. She doesn't quite happen. But the very next year is the year that Vanessa Williams becomes Miss America. So when she told me that, and when there was that moment of like, well, actually, I thought there's a story there. There's a real story there, and somebody needs to write it.
Yeah. Well, it's an ambitious one, too, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because getting down to the truth, getting down to or whatever we perceive as the truth, but make it also interesting for your average reader. I think you did an incredible job.
One of the issues, especially with doing oral history, which is what this started off as, is you have to verify it. And that means you have to find sources. And the thing is, if you were busy making change, you weren't necessarily documenting the change that you were making, right? Or if you were moving around, or if you were kind of changing your life circumstances, you had to have a space and a commitment to saving the records. And Dorothy was just too much of an activist to do that. And so as a historian, I had to use every skill I had to try to find external verification, because a lot of times people will tell you they've done something or they might remember it, but you really need to verify it. And so I literally found myself, one point in time, I was pushing through every single page in the congressional record on this particular event, the 1972 child care protest. Dorothy had said she was there, but I looked through this entire record and couldn't find anything with her name on it. But I actually found a picture, and there was a picture with her in it, unidentified, but it was clearly her and her daughter Patrice at the 1972 hearing, and she was actually organizing the people who were speaking in favor of the Comprehensive Child Care Act in 1972. We came very close as a country to having comprehensive child care, something that, of course, in the pandemic, we really wish we had. And it gets vetoed by Nixon twice, actually, vetoing the bill twice. It gets through two times. And it was really a testament to Dorothy's commitment from the very beginning on making sure that the women's movement thought about child care and thought about children, which is not something that a lot of people remember. A lot of people think about the women's movement focusing on the issues of abortion or choice. But I think that happens to be a particular way in which the movement gets framed in the news and doesn't really recognize the way in which feminists were working at all levels to really try and think about these issues like childcare and wealth and housing and access to resources and protection from violence.
Tell me a few key points that you think are critical in this book.
So this book comes at an answer to a claim that, in fact, the women's movement is a white women's movement. And it actually says, no, it's only a white women's movement if you ignore the African-American women who were there from the beginning, like Dorothy. And so when we dismiss that movement, we have to kind of label it in a particular way. And what I think was really interesting was the way that I could find in the coverage, you know, Dorothy is literally the person who talks Gloria Steinem into traveling and into speaking in public. And the two of them share the stage for almost 2 years, almost flat out traveling and speaking in public. What I can do is I can mark the way in which the press decides that Steinem will become the figurehead of the women's movement in the 70s. And they move Dorothy out of their consideration or their discussion, even though it was very important to the two of them that it be a black and a white woman, and that they talk about issues of race and discrimination and struggle. So later on, we find this adoption of the word intersectionality when people talk about the women's movement. But what you can see is it's there from the very beginning, even earlier than this, right? The way in which Pauline Murray, for example, winds up influencing Betty Friedan. So even 10 years before Dorothy and Gloria start traveling, right? African-American women are there. So I think that's an important part about the book. Dorothy is just one of these extraordinary people. She is able to understand before anyone else can the way in which Clinton policies designed to encourage employment in the city are really actually targeted at what we would think of as neoliberal economic development. So the Empowerment Zone program, she initially believes is going to be a way to encourage small business owners, in her case in Harlem, to flourish. And what she realizes is that this is a sellout and they're really going to be facilitating the development of big box stores going into and replacing small business owners. So even though one of the core tenets of community development and of economic resurgence in policies is often a kind of celebration of small business, what she realizes is that that is not at all the agenda. And so she can mark how programs that seem to be designed to resuscitate a community actually facilitate gentrification. Trump will actually resuscitate that kind of program. I think he called it Opportunity Zone. And so it's very clearly something that influences economic development in cities today. But she is one of the very first people to really critique it. And I think one of the only people to do so. So she does that, right, after she winds up doing this community organizing in terms of her daycare center and running community mm-hmm. centers. She runs into business and she finds the same kind of obstacles. And she names it.
What I found the most compelling about this book, asking the questions, pushing her concern to the decision makers, and she was pretty successful, which I found, wow, this woman is highly favored with all races. Let me tell you, there was something in that book that really upset me. And it was when she was having female pains and she went to the doctor
oh
and he insisted that she had sex immediately. And of course she gets pregnant.
I put that in with her permission.
Yeah.
And I put it in because I think it speaks to the lack of education. She was having trouble with her menstrual cycle. And so she goes to a gynecologist. This is in the early 1960s in New York. She goes to a gynecologist who then tells her that the reason she's having trouble is that she hasn't had any sex. And so he tells her that what you need to do to solve that is to have sex, which is what's interesting is it kind of speaks to the folk perception about women's bodies and the lack of medical knowledge about the functioning of women's bodies, which is still true today for the most part. We have a much better understanding, for example, of the chemical composition of, if it's okay to say, of semen than we do of female fluids, right? So there's this lack of understanding of women's bodies that really comes into play in that setting. She gets told, you know, to relieve these pains, you have to have sex, but the doctor doesn't inform her about birth control. Because actually at that time, birth control would not necessarily have been legal. It's illegal for unmarried women until...
But you're sitting there prescribing non-marital
yeah.
sex.
But it's just the fact that that was the solution.
Yeah.
For menstrual pains was have sex. Without any notion that you have to explain to somebody how. And I think that might have been because he was a white doctor and she was an African-American. And he makes an assumption about her sexual practices. And so he doesn't bother to tell her to use birth control, even if this was going to work, right? It doesn't work. It's a false.
Why not tell her to get a dildo? What's the difference?
I don't think there was any medical advice
yeah.
connected.
You know what
between.
I'm saying? Like,
I think it was more about ignorance of women's bodies.
Right. That really drives the point.
Yeah. I think that you can understand, given that experience, why for her the women's movement is really salient, right? Why guaranteeing somebody access to information about birth control, guaranteeing somebody access to information about their bodies, or the right to make decisions about whether or not to become a mother, right, in light of, at the time, kind of limited information about birth control and the effectiveness of birth control. I think for her, this is a part of, it's a profoundly, has a profound impact on her life. But I think she also then understands, and this is the point that somebody like Loretta Ross makes, that African-American women are very much at the lead on reproductive politics. But we tend not to think about that because of the way in which we've boiled it down to being seen as a white women's movement.
Well, I liked what you said earlier about, well, it is a white women's movement if you're not counting all the black women that were involved in it in the beginning. You know,
yeah.
I liked that statement because that was the narrative for a really long time.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you want anyone to know about this book that we haven't discussed? And maybe how it, in your opinion, do you think that this will help to shape views, opinions, will change some mindsets?
I'm really hoping that what this book does is it demands that we go back and we rethink what we know about history. And we go back and we reassess our assumptions about African-American women and feminism. And I'm following this book up with another book on African-American women at the Houston National Women's Conference in 1977 that begins with the same kind of premise. You know, the Houston Conference is it's the answer to the Mexico City 1975 call from the UN for women's decade. The U.S. gets around to holding their National Women's Conference 2 years later, and we hold it in Barbara Jordan's home district. And yet, Jordan is almost not identified in a lot of the literature that focuses on this event. So I hope that what we get from this is a reassessment of what we understand about these movements and how important it is to really go back and look at what they were calling for. Dorothy can create the community childcare center and the community services that she can, in part because she has access to Office of Economic Opportunity money through Johnson, the War on Poverty, right? And everything I've seen, everyone who had any kind of relationship to a program that came out of that program, of that War on Poverty, really had a sense of rights and of access and of community investment. And even though there are a lot of critics of the program and the way in which it worked, I think that the fact that as a government, we imagined that community development mattered, had this important impact on the way in which people think about what they can do for themselves. Dorothy is somebody who is self-made, who, you know, figures out what she needs to do and figures out what her community needs and does it. She created the childcare office and program for the whole city. And I think that understanding that the importance of that message that you can do it, that what is possible comes from the community, is really, I think, the most important part of this book and about her life and about what I take away from learning about her.
Professor Laura Lovett is the author of many significant historical works documenting important events that have impacted women, causing us to ask critical questions about past legislation that led to inclusion, diversity, civil rights, women's rights, and more. This book by Laura Lovett is yet another piece of documented history. It is a biography titled With Her Fist Raised, Dorothy Pittman Hughes and the Transformative Power of Black Community Activism. This is a critical historical account that is relevant to today's women empowerment movements. This episode is sponsored by Bella Composers, and you're listening to Amy Marie by People's Republic. This is off of a new Rite of Passage CD.
Yeah.